This podcast is a proud member of the CipherCast Network. Discover more at CipherCast.net and follow us on Twitter at CipherCastNet.
Greetings, this is Jim Ryan of the CipherCast. You're about to hear audio from the Monty Cook Games panel at DragonCon 2018 in Atlanta, Georgia. Monty Cook and Shauna Germain were there. They talked about Numenera, Invisible Sun, No Thank You Evil, and a number of other things. A good portion of the panel was a Q&A session, so a lot of different topics came up. We hope you enjoy it!
A little bit, so you're going to be stuck probably hearing more from me than from Shauna, but I'm sure she'll still have stuff to say. By means of introduction, I am Monty Cook, Monty Cook Games. I've been, this is my 30th year as a full-time game designer, and
there are a lot of people who can say that.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Cool. So I worked on a lot of different games, probably best known still even today for Dungeons & Dragons,
yay,
various editions, and I recently, which is why we're here today, started Monty Cook Games with Shauna Germain.
You're not going to introduce me, is that?
No, I'm just kidding.
I'm Shauna Germain, co-owner and founder with Monty of Monty Cook Games. I come from a writing background, so my background is writing poetry, short fiction, erotica, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and then moved into doing game design when we started the company.
So that mean that games are going to be more erotic?
They are, yes. If you've read my stuff, you know the answer to that. sex and death are my things. That's probably all you need to know about me. And we're going to talk today a little bit about what we're working on, what we've got coming up. We're going to do a lot of room for questions so that you guys can ask what's on your mind. We're happy to talk about sort of anything from the company itself to game design to Kickstarter, which we do a lot of, kind of anything. So we're kind of here for you guys.
So we started MCG in 2012 with the Kickstarter for Numenera, and at that time we actually had no sort of idea that MCG was going to become as big and a full-time thing as we did. We just thought we were going to put out this book called Numenera, and we needed a company name to stick onto Kickstarter.
Monty's pro was, we're going to make a little game. Little tiny game.
Right. And, Shauna wanted in. Thought it sounded like fun, so we did that together. And, of course, that Kickstarter went on to, at the time, break all the records that there were. Launched an entire product line for Numenera, and that kind of got us started on the way. We now have 9, soon to probably be 10 full-time employees, and Shauna and I are the co-owners, along with another gentleman, Charles Ryan, who used to be the brand manager of Dungeons & Dragons. We have great full-time game designers on staff with us, like Bruce Cordell and Sean Reynolds.
And Darcy Ross, our community manager, you guys have probably met. It's fantastic. We have a great team.
It's a great team. We're really happy with how everything has gone. And, like I said, that was 2012, so we are now in year 6 of this. And, we are coming up on a period of time when we are launching 2 really big things for us. We are delivering on the Kickstarters now, which means that it'll go into stores here in the next couple of months. A game called Invisible Sun, which is a game of surreal fantasy, and we have a new version of Numenera coming out this year. Numenera is now a two-book set and a nice slipcase. I mean, you can get the books individually, but get the slipcase because it's really beautiful and it doesn't cost you more. And so those are the two things. Invisible Sun will be out like in a week in stores, and the new version of Numenera will be out in about a month in stores. And like I said, already delivering to Kickstarter backers. And so, actually, it would actually help me a lot to know, like, who here is already kind of familiar with what Numenera is? So quite a few. So I won't go into that too much then. But what we've done is we've taken the idea of Numenera, which is this super far future science fantasy setting with its own rules, and we have expanded it so that, we've always said that Numenera was about people way, way, way far in the future exploring the ruins of the past to build a better future. And so they're combing through the remains of these past civilizations, which rose to, incredible heights. And so even though the people of the setting don't fully understand it all and kind of think of it as magic, they're still surrounded by all of this, these leftovers of the past. And what we've done is we've really decided to focus as much on that build a better future part as we had been exploring the past part. So basically there's it's a two-book set now. One's called Discovery, and that's the Numenera that sort of everyone is familiar with. It's exploring the past, and you've got characters that go into these weird ruins and encounter, inexplicable things that they don't fully understand. They think of it as magic, but it's actually super advanced technology. But the new part of it, there are new parts to Discovery, but the really kind of exciting thing is the second book, which is called Destiny. And Destiny is where we provide all kinds of rules and information and guidelines for taking that stuff that you find and using it to build new things, using it to establish a community, right? Using it to make your life better and the world a better place and whatnot, so that, you can almost look at Numenera and the Ninth World kind of almost like a post-apocalyptic kind of thing, right? Because you're, exploring the ruins and you're finding stuff. But now we're kind of taking it a step beyond just sort of that traditional post-apocalyptic, how are you going to survive kind of thing. And we're kind of trying to put the players more in the driver's seat and say, okay, you've got all this cool stuff. Now, what are you going to do? Right? What are you going to build? What kind of community are you going to found? What kind of society are you going to help shape? And I think that's really exciting. It's something that you don't get a lot of opportunities to do in games, and I think that is something that I'm really proud that Numenera is going to offer as a part of its play experience. You can still do all the things that you did before, right? Go into weird ruins and encounter weird creatures and do all that stuff, but now there's like another reason to do it if you want to go that far. Okay. Just didn't want to keep talking.
My instinct is to say, because like we all need the tools to build a better future right now, right? So like I feel like this is really this is a hard project in a lot of ways for me, because there is a thing about scavenging from the ruins, but man, like I wanna at least in my games have the power to build a better future, have a power to build a better world. And so that's something that I'm super, super passionate about and really glad I got to help sort of shape that a little bit.
Yeah. And then the other game that I mentioned is Invisible Sun. Is anybody familiar with Invisible Sun? A little bit fewer. So Invisible Sun is, as I mentioned, a game of surreal fantasy. The conceit in Invisible Sun is that you and I, we all discover that all of this this, all of DragonCon, all of Atlanta, all of Earth, is actually nothing more than a shadow. It's not real. And that we came here to hide from a terrible war, but the lies of shadow made us think that this was reality, when in fact, reality is much bigger, much cooler, much brighter, much more colorful, and we call that the actuality, and characters go into the actuality, and in Invisible Sun, basically, magic is so prevalent that every player character is someone who uses magic. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all D&D wizards, because everybody uses magic differently, depending on the order of magic that you belong to. So if you belong to the Goetic Order, right, you summon spirits and demons and angels to do your bidding. If you are a Vancian, cast lots of spells and you prepare spells ahead of time and things like that. But if you're a maker, you don't do any of that necessarily. Instead, you make magical items. Your power comes from the things that you make. And so there's a lot of different ways that magic kind of is expressed in the game. And the cool thing about that, the cool gameplay part of that is, you might not actually even really understand how your fellow player character's magic works, right? So I might sit down and, I'm going to cast my spells and whatnot, but then Shauna, it's her turn, and she does something, and, is basically using mechanics, using flavor, using parts of the game that I never had to learn because I'm not playing the character that she's playing, so I have no idea how that even just happened, right? That she just, conjured this thing. And that's really interesting, because one of the things about Invisible Sun that was really, really important to me was making magic mysterious and magical and not always entirely predictable. And so the idea behind that is that even if you're a learned, person who uses magic yourself, there you're still going to be encountering things that you don't understand. There's still mysteries. There's lots and lots of secrets in this game. Secrets are kind of a core component. You're constantly learning new secrets and uncovering things and exploring this new world that you were once a part of, but then you intentionally fled, and only now have you recently returned to it. You're kind of once again getting your feet, getting your bearings to understand what it is to be someone in the actuality.
I think it's also really important to state that it comes in a 30-pound box. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, 28.8 pounds of awesomeness that is books and cards and this fantastic six-figure hand and a sooth deck. And just like, I mean, because it's designed to be played at the table with a group and it's very tactile, it's got like all this cool stuff, which was so much fun and so hard at the same time to make, because no one had ever done that before. And so like our art director and our production team, they were like, you want us to do what? We were like, yes, please. And so, to see the thing alone is sort of awesome. Boy, that was a lot of work, but I'm really happy with how it came out.
Yeah, there's six total, counting an art book and a GM's notebook, there are six books in the game. There are over 1,000 cards. There's the hand that Shauna mentioned. It's full of a lot of stuff. The idea is, when you sit down and you open up one of those great games like Fantasy Flight makes, right, that are full of all these cool components and stuff. I wanted that experience, but for a role-playing game. So that's part of the very deluxe nature of Invisible Sun, and really, really happy with how it came out. All comes in, like Shauna said, the black cube, and it's something that's really kind of, it's been a very much a passion project for me. And there's lots more I could tell you about it, but I'm not going to go on and on and on about it. We should mention No Thank You Evil.
Oh, okay. Has anybody played No Thank You Evil? Yay! So I'm doing a panel on gaming with kids right after this, same room. I don't think Uevo is our game for kids. It's designed for players 4 to 5 and older. And it's specifically designed so that you can play with siblings. So, like, you can play with a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And there are 3 sets of character sheets so that everyone can play at the same time. No one feels like they're too young or too old. And it's also designed to be really good for children who are on the autism spectrum, children who have vision issues or are colorblind. We worked with fonts for kids who have trouble reading. And for kids who have tactile or sensory issues, we made the tokens like really smooth and stuff so that it doesn't bother them as they hold it. So we did a lot of work on the back end to make it really accessible for kids of all kids who wanted to get into role-playing games, which is mostly kids whose parents play role-playing games, it turns out. And it's called No Thank You Evil, and there's a little thing that you hold up if it gets scary that just says No Thank You Evil on it. So you sort of have a Kid X card. So if the monsters under the bed are too scary, you can kind of be like, no, and you know, everybody stops and they backtrack, and you know, the monsters grow wings or whatever is going to make that huge for the kids. And so it's a 6-sided game, so kids don't have to count very high. And it's designed so that all of their tokens, all of their pools are very small. So there's a little tiny, tiny bit of math just to sort of, you know, push kids who are older, but not very much. And it's designed, so it's a world called Storia, and you get there by going under the bed is one world, and into the closet is one world, and out the window is another world, and they're all slightly different. So under the bed is like a little older, a little scarier. Out the window is like cool adventures, like hot air ballooning, or airplanes, or spaceships. Into the closet is you know, sort of more fairy tale, magical kind of stuff. So each world has a thing that's designed to be of interest to whatever interests your children at that age. We do a lot of adventures, and we also have a story pack that lets you build your own adventures and has maps that you can create. It's just a deck of cards. A lot of people use that on road trips and stuff because you don't actually have to use the core game with that. You can just build an adventure, tell a story, that kind of thing. We did it because a lot of our players are parents who were playing with their kids, and so they were tweaking Numenera, which is sort of a dark setting. And so they were doing like Disneyland Numenera and Santa Numenera. And it was awesome to watch them do it. I mean, it was really, really cool. But at the same time, we were like, you know, we can make this easier on you. And so that was kind of where the inspiration for that came from.
Yeah. I would probably be remiss not mentioning the brand new project that we just launched via Kickstarter. The Kickstarter ended about a week ago.
Thank goodness.
And this is for a brand new thing for us. It's a book called Your Best Game Ever. And it is not a rule book. It is not a game. But instead, it is a book of guidelines and advice and suggestions for anyone who plays any role-playing game, to just how to have a better experience. And this is for players and for GMs. It's, you know, like I said, system agnostic, although there's plenty of actionable suggestions, you know, the things that you can do to your game in order to get a desired result, you know, ways to maybe add elements or tweak rules or whatever. But the main idea is that this is for anybody, whether you play D&D or Pathfinder or Numenera or Fate or whatever your favorite game is. We want to embrace, you know, everyone who plays these crazy games. And like I said, the Kickstarter ended about a week ago, but if you're just hearing about it now for the first time and it sounds of interest to you, on both the back tables, There's a flyer. There's still a way to get in on the amazing deals that, you know, came out of the Kickstarter because, you know, we unlocked a lot of stretch goals and stuff like that. So if you want, you can check that out. There's a URL. The handout actually says that the Kickstarter is still going on. It's not, but the URL still works.
We have a great consulting team. Some names that you guys might know. Matt Coville is part of our consulting team.
Matt Mercer. Ila LaSanta. Alina Pete. Tanya DePass.
Yeah, Tanya Stacy, who runs Contessa. So we have this great consulting expert team who's going to help us look at the book, make it better, write up their own tips. And then we also have a bunch of really fantastic cartoonists and comics like John Kowalik and Dungeons and Doggos. And a bunch of other. Athena also does Where
Right.
Which is fantastic. So we're super excited about the team
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really special book, and we're really looking forward to it. That'll come out about a year from now. So, you know, we're always planning way ahead. But yeah, so that's sort of the big things that Monte Cook Games has going on right now. You know, do you have anything to add? We can just talk about...
If we go to questions, then we make sure that we talk about the things that you want us to talk about.
So feel
free
to,
like I said before, we'll talk about anything. We're kind of open book, so feel free to stand at the mic and ask any questions that you have. The only thing we can't answer is what our next Kickstarter is.
But, you know, yeah, anything. Even, you know, stuff that we've worked on that isn't Monte Cook Games. Anything you want.
So I come from a background playing largely 3.5 Dungeons & Dragons and Pathfinder. However, I was very generously gifted with the Kickstarter for Invisible Sun for Christmas last year. And I was just curious, you know, sort of coming from that background very specifically. I played a little bit of Numenera, but mostly my background has been 3.5 D&D. You know, maybe some advice sort of flipping to this new system, there's some pitfalls that I might run into just because my brain is hardwired to that system.
Are you going to be the GM?
I am.
Okay, cool.
I am, so I've been told.
So here's the number one thing that you're going to find to be the most different from D&D or Pathfinder and Invisible Sun. That is, in a D&D game, the game master creates an adventure, right, and then sprinkles in some hooks or whatever and gets the players to you know, sort of jump on the train, and then the train goes. Invisible Sun works almost exactly the opposite. And what I mean by that is when you create your character, one of the things that you're going to create in Invisible Sun is your character arc, right? And this works just like if you are reading a novel and you're reading about a character that has a character arc, you're watching some, you know, television show that where you see the character grow and change and, you know, have a goal on episode one and reach that goal on episode 12 or something. And what that does to gameplay is that it means that you don't necessarily have to be feeding them a lot of hooks. Instead, they're going to be coming to you and they're going to say, okay, well, I've got this character arc where I want revenge on, you know, this guy that killed my father, right? And so the first step of this character arc is I have to find this person. So I want to find this person. Where do I go, right? And so you're going to be spending more time kind of reacting to what they want to do rather than reacting to what you want them to do. And you can still, you know, create interesting scenarios and stories because, you know, you as the GM gets to decide, well, what is it going to take to find this guy who killed your father, right? You're the one who decides that, and so you're still the game master, but they're going to be providing all the motivation. And that's kind of weird to get your mind around sometimes as a game master because you're used to the responsibilities being the opposite. But it's actually much easier. I tend to try to make games that are really, really easy to GM because I am usually the GM in my group and I'm lazy.
And mean. Don't forget the mean part. In our Invisible Sun game, which we've been sort of playtesting since long before the game actually finished, Monty said that sometimes he can just sit there for a couple hours and just listen to us like talk and figure out what our characters are doing. And he doesn't, but it is the most sort of story-driven game that I've ever played. And so like the narrative of my character, you know, my character's first arc was Fall from Grace. And so it was this really, where it was this moment where like she had to be striving for something and lose everything. And so, like, even though, so I knew what I was striving for, but, like, as the GM, Monty was able to make this, like, this sort of huge heartbreak moment that affected her next arc and going forward. And so that idea of being reactive is really, really fun, but I think he's right that it's harder to kind of grow up a little bit.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited to hear how it goes.
Okay, sure.
No time.
Hi.
Hey, y'all. So I just kind of wanted to ask both of y'all, just with all your years of experience in the hobby and the industry and so on, having played, I guess, many different systems at different points, how does it affect y'all's thoughts? I guess, what would be your favorite system and or game that you played, how does that affect y'all's thoughts as designers and players and game masters and so on? How does that, I guess, how does cross RPG experience tie into, you know, thoughts as being player, designer, and game master?
Well, so if the game that I worked on wasn't my favorite game, I would have to say there was something wrong, right? Because, you know, that's my job. My job is to make the best game that I can. So, you know, I know it sounds weird and biased to say, well, you know, my games are the best, right? But you know, in my opinion, they are, and they have to be. And that doesn't mean that I demand anyone else feel that way. But, you know, ultimately, I have to design a game that I think would be super fun to play. Otherwise, what am I doing? And on top of that, right, in that same mentality, like, my favorite game needs to be the one I'm working on right now, right? Because again, if it's not, why am I making a substandard game? So, you know, Invisible Sun, Numenera, these are my favorite games. I have lots of other favorite games. You know, I have worked on a lot of games and have enjoyed them all. And there are games that I've never worked on. Like, I've never worked on straight up Chaosium Call of Cthulhu, but I love it and I play it all the time. And so I think it behooves us as game designers to play a lot of the games that we make, but also play a lot of other games.
Yeah, I'm a huge Magpie. So, like, everything I play, we played a game last night, and I was like, oh, that's cool. I like this idea. I also play a lot of video games, and I'm always like, how would that work at the table? Like, what can I pull from that? And sometimes, like, Monty and I'll be playing, like, you're playing No Man's Sky, and I'm playing ESO right now. And so we'll play, and then we'll come together, and we'll talk about, well, this game does this, and this game does this, and how do we make that a cool tabletop thing? And so, like, I think that thinking about games critically, not, and I don't mean negatively, right, just critically as a designer, I think about games all the time. Why did I love that so much? Why did I find that boring or frustrating? And I think, like, just sort of stealing all these ideas and, like, mushing them together in my brain for a little while and seeing what comes out is kind of actually my favorite part of game design. I also love a ton of games. I mean, I really like online gaming because it asks for a different thing, and as an introvert, it gives me different things than gaming at the table. But gaming at the table, like, I think that really like narrative, story-driven, character-driven games, and so those really appealed to me. I recently played Fallen Magic, which I thought was fantastic and different and made me uncomfortable because it puts the spotlight on you, but that's still so, it's still so cool to grow in that way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I like questions because I get to talk about a thing I didn't know that I knew.
First off, Mr. Cook, it was great seeing you as the High Priest of Theron in Darkness Rising. My question was, you mentioned designing games for children and with certain needs in mind. What do you think about the challenge? I mean, obviously there's the raw mechanics and flavor and story with game design, but how does thinking about the audience or the needs of the gamer affect how you design a game? Or what do you like about that?
Sure, yeah. Well, I think, you know, because I come from a story background, I think it's very similar to me. You know, I come from a writing background, and my goal as a writer is to not waste your time, because your time is valuable, right? So I'm not going to tell a boring story about boring people, because you have way, way better things to do with your time. So I feel that about gaming, particularly as adults, like getting a group of people together to game is a huge time commitment. It's just giant. It's so hard. And so the first thing I always think is, like, I will not waste these people's time. This will be as awesome as I can make it. So that's kind of my first sort of impulse to the audience. I also think about, like, you know, what you can't make a game that's perfect for everyone, because then it just sort of is a hodgepodge of murk, right? And so I think, like, this game is designed for people who will like X, and so I have to make it the best game for those people. And so thinking about the audience in terms of, like, who they might be and who would appreciate this game and why, I think is a really important directive for me when I think about a game. I worked on a game called Predation last year, which was dinosaurs and time travel, which are two things that, like, yay for me. And so I was like, all right, so people who pick this up, it's got a giant dinosaur and lasers on the cover, right? So people who pick up this game are going to like dinosaurs and lasers. So how do I optimize those two things, those elements of science and dinosaurs and time travel, to make this sort of the best experience? And the way that we did that was we gave everyone at the table a dinosaur companion, But the person that plays it is someone else. So you have your character as a companion, but the person next to you, for example, plays the dinosaur. And so it adds this whole sort of fantastic element where everybody gets to be a dinosaur, which, come on, really? Isn't that, am I the only one that, you know, really wants that? So I really think a lot about what's going to be awesome at the table for the people who already kind of, I think, would like this particular game or setting.
I think that thinking about the audience and who's actually going to play the game is totally the key of good game design. And we talk a lot about, you know, different kinds of gamers and how, like, you know, this person likes combat and this person likes problem solving and whatnot. And that's all very valid. But I think that you can go even deeper than that and think about the way that people engage with the role-playing game. And if you guys are role-playing gamers, you're going to know exactly what I mean, right? There's the person who's, like, always the first one to talk, jumps right in, says, you know, talks to the NPCs, even if they don't have the character who's good at that, right? And they're just like, you know, they're the extrovert, right? They are out there, they're talking a lot. And sometimes I think that games end up getting kind of biased toward those people. But, you know, like, I'll just tell you an anecdote, and Sean has heard this 1,000 times, so sorry. But, you know, a long time ago, 20 years ago, I was running a D&D game, and there was a woman at the table, and, you know, a couple of sessions had gone by, and she didn't seem to be engaging with the game. She was very quiet. And so after the game session, I, you know, kind of took her aside and I said, "Are you having any fun? Are you enjoying this?" And, you know, it was as though I threw open a couple of doors, because all of a sudden she just started telling me about, like, this inner life of her character, and she hates this character and she loves this guy, and, you know, she really wants to hunt down that villain, and here's why. And, you know, it occurred to me, it became very clear to me, right, that there's this whole sort of inner world going on at the table that sort of I and the other players aren't even privy to. But as long as I was able to, as the game master, make space for her and give her the things that she needed to do that, she was having a fantastic time. So, you know, like in Invisible Sun, for example, there is a section on, you know, what do you do if you've got an introvert player? How do you interact with them, right? And because part of Invisible Sun, it's very character-driven, it's very narrative-focused, right? And so it expects the players to kind of step up and say, well, I'm going to go do this, and I need to find this guy, right? And, you know, what if the person doesn't want to do that? Well, you know, we give you some ways around that then, right? We give you other ways for the player to interact with the game master. Maybe that happens away from the table, right? Without, you know, on a one-on-one situation, because some people are way more comfortable one-on-one than they are at the table with a bunch of people. You know, it addresses things like that. And, you know, it's that thinking process that actually sort of evolved into your best game ever. And thinking about just sort of the way people play games and the things that we do, you know, to play games, because we don't all play them the same. And there isn't a right or a wrong way. There's just a lot of different ways.
So I'm a backer of Invisible Sun. And the group that I hope to run with it mostly plays in a somebody else runs it, a D&D that's very right training. Mm. So, which is fine. I mean, so the problem I had, I ran them through a game of the strength, and they really struggled with open-ended situations.
Right.
They were really looking for, you know, where's the button I press that you know, does the next thing? It's like, there is no button. Tell me what you want to do.
Right.
So I'm a little worried about Invisible Sun, taking these people into Invisible Sun and having them flail around trying to find the rail line.
Right. Well, so I'm very, very familiar with this situation. And so what Invisible Sun does is it systematizes that, in that, like I said, every character has a character arc, right? And there are these detailed, you know, delineated steps, right, between, you know, starting the arc and finishing the arc, right? There's this step, this step, this step. Each one of them has an experience point award attached to them, right? So that is the way your character advances, is moving through these steps. And it's spelled out for you. So even if you're the kind of person who's like, I don't know what I'm going to do, your character arc actually tells you what you're going to do. And so, you know, all you had to do was choose that arc, right? Because, like, you know, the, we're going to use the, I want the revenge on the guy who killed my father. You know, my name is Ignacio Latoya, prepare to die, right? It's all spelled out there, right? The, you know, the step one is swearing your revenge. Step two is, you know, tracking him down, and that might be actually a couple of different steps, right? Step three is confronting him, and you know, finally the climax is, do you succeed in getting your revenge or not, right? Because failure is an option at the end of a character arc, right? And then there's a resolution at the end, and each one of those, you know, you can see being an entire game session. So you're letting the player guide you along, but really it's the character guiding the player.
It's almost like a mental railroad, I think of it. Like, it, you know, in a D&D adventure, it's an external train that you're getting on. And like in something like Invisible Sun, it's an internal train where you, like, the whole adventure is your own character movement, which I think sometimes helps with that visual transition too.
So you mentioned Invisible Sun being a very, very tactile game, designed to be a played around a table with a bunch of props and such. Can the game be adapted to a situation where one player or all players are remote?
Sure, right. You know, there's going to be some stuff that's lost in translation, right? You're going to sort of miss the cool interaction and the visual elements and whatnot. But you know, it's. It's not that hard to, you know, when you draw a card from the sooth deck, you know, hold it up, you know, to the camera on your computer and say, okay, I just drew this card. And I mean, it's a little bit more challenging, but I would argue that pretty much any game, you know, a virtual setup like that has its own challenges. And in fact, plug time again, right? That is going to be a whole chapter in your best game ever, is the challenges of running a game where, you know, you're scattered all over the country or the world, and you're all playing virtually. Because I play that way a lot too, but I certainly have found that there are some brand new challenges in that.
You can check out the Mindkick Games Twitch channel too. We have a number of people who are running Invisible Sun games online already. Not from MCG, but like you know, people who are already doing it, and you can see the ways in which they're adapting. And I do think like we've played both ways. And it loses something away from the table and away from the tactile. And I think the thing that loses is this, right? These moments where your characters are, like, conspiring or whatever. But like Monty said, I think that's true of all games. It's just sort of heightened in Invisible Sun. You get to, like, pass your wicked key to someone, like, actually hand it to them. Or you know, have your medallion on, those kinds of things. And so I think it works, but I think it takes a little extra step to sort of grok those emotional spaces.
So I feel kind of dumb. Before going into these panels over this weekend, I had no idea that there was a D20 variant of Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, yeah.
That was like my main gateway to like tabletop gaming. When you were making the D20 variant of that game, what was your main goal in doing that? Because I think, at least for me, a big part of that system is its sort of simplicity. I think it's very simple to get people
right.
in. You know, you have a skill, and if you want to do something with that skill, you roll a D100.
Right.
If you get out or below it, you succeed.
Right.
If not, you fail. But and I guess I'm just not really...
So here's the story of how that game came about. D20 Call of Cthulhu? Yeah. In case you didn't hear, yes. So he's asking about the D20 Call of Cthulhu, what was the goal? So this was something that it's been 17 years now, but this was in the early days of third edition. If you remember back then, this was the D20 license, right? We're going to try to take the D&D system and we're going to try to apply it to all these different games and genres and whatnot. And essentially, the Wizards of the Coast brand manager came to me and said, if you could make any game a D20 game, what would it be? And I didn't hesitate for a second. I said Call of Cthulhu, because just because I loved Call of Cthulhu, right? And so Wizards of the Coast went and got the license for Call of Cthulhu from Chaosium. And so the idea was twofold. The goal was twofold. One was to show, to kind of put our money where our mouth was and say, yes, these D20 rules can be used in all kinds of different things beyond just Dungeons & Dragons. But just as importantly, it was to introduce a whole big group of gamers who only ever played D&D and introduce them to a different genre, right? And I think Call of Cthulhu is a great one to choose for that. And so what the book does is it creates kind of a hybrid in that you still have sanity rules that work just like in regular Call of Cthulhu, but you know, you've also got you're not playing D&D, right? It's still the Call of Cthulhu setting. But, you know, you've got D&D rules and you've got stats 3 to 18. Well, Call of Cthulhu has stats 3 to 18, too. But anyway, you know, it still uses those rules that people would already be familiar with. And because of that, it ends up being a way to play a little bit more of a pulpy Call of Cthulhu than a straight-up Call of Cthulhu, because your characters are tougher, your characters are a little more resilient. But, you know, you still run into some, you know, potent mythos creature, and it still squashes you like a bug, right? Exactly the way it does in Call of Cthulhu. And, you know, the way that we expressed, you know, we gave stats. I guess, you know, Call of Cthulhu does too, right? But there were stats for Nyarlathotep and Cthulhu and whatnot, but they're so crazy, crazy powerful that, you know, it was really a game mechanic way of saying, no, you don't interact directly with these beings, right? And this is just, we're showing you in a very dramatic way that you're never going to be able to enter. You know, you can raise all the levels you want. You're never going to be able to, you know, sort of cope with these creatures. And so, narratively, it was a different way of expressing that same sentiment that you get in Call of Cthulhu.
So, talking about Invisible Sun, and you said everybody uses magic. And it sounded to me, reminded me of 4th edition D&D a little bit, and something people loved and hated, like fighters had fantastic powers. Was that something y'all did intentionally to, like, solve the whole quadratic wizard linear fighter thing? Is that something y'all did on purpose?
Something we did on purpose, but not for that reason. It was much more a what-if scenario, right? What if you had a bunch of wizards, but they all worked completely differently and had to you know, make their way in the world in that way, right? And so everyone is going to sort of interface with the world in a completely different way because they have a completely different kind of magic. And the different types of characters, it doesn't feel like, because of the nature of the game, it doesn't feel like you're, oh, I wish we had a fighter. Because, you know, there are other ways to solve those problems, right? The fighter is just one solution to one kind of problem. I guess I've kind of lost my train. But,
I was thinking about what we were talking about earlier about creating games for different kinds of players. And one of the things that I really love about Invisible Sun is each type of magic is sort of for a different type of player. And so, like, if you are a Goetic, which, like, I play Goetic, and so your magic is all about summoning and interacting with these otherworldly beings. But if you're a Maker, there's actually, like, there's some math and some, like, thinking about the ingredients that you have. And, some, like, it's got this whole different element of how you do magic that appeals to different people. And then we have the apostate who's like, real, like, I'm doing my own kind of magic and you guys don't get it, nobody gets it, and my character sheet's a mess and it's awesome. And it's just this sort of like, so like, it's just glorious. Like, the character sheet has no words on it, it's just these giant scribbles. And that's one of the things, like, each type has their own different character sheet. So, like, the Goetic character sheet, it has a lot of circles because they do a lot of summoning and have some circle elements. And then there's a Weaver who just gets these cool sort of ideas, these facets, and can turn, weave them into anything. It's this poetic, magical kind of feeling when you cast them. And so, like, each of them appeals to a really different player type, I think, which is really fun. And, you know, like, it's fun to try different ones, but it's also sort of like, all right, well, this is, I know what kind of player I am. This is my home base. This is, like, this is my thing. So I think that's kind of fun, too.
So I'm curious about this book from a game design perspective and also from in terms of running or playing games. When you're making different games that use the same or similar system, like the Cypher system has the Strange and Numenera and other offshoots, or the D20 system, how do you go about making those games feel like different independent games and not just a, you know, reskinning of the same game?
So one of the things that we do is we think first about the needs of the game and how do we best serve the needs. And those needs come from genre, right? They come from the kinds of things that players are going to expect, the kind of experiences the players are going to want to have in that game, right? So in Shauna's predation game, right, she sort of latched onto this idea of everyone has a dinosaur companion, and you know, nothing like that exists anywhere else in the Cypher system because it works for predation, but you know, if you play Numenera, there's no reason to have a dinosaur companion, although that would be cool. Whoa. Is my foot tangled on there? Thank you so much. And so that, you know, that's first and foremost, it's serving the needs of the game and the gamer and, you know, sort of making it work within the context of the system is second. But I can say that because, you know, the system is so, that particular system is so open and has so few constraints on it that there aren't a lot of barriers. There aren't a lot of things that keep us from, you know, doing different things. You know, like, you know, when you brought up the problem with the wizard versus the fighter in D&D, that is a challenge when you're working with the D20 system, right? Because you do have an issue there where, you know, if you've got characters sort of progressing in different ways, you know, even if you change up the genre, right, and you're talking about someone with psychic powers versus, you know, someone who flies spaceships and, you know, you're playing some kind of science fiction D20 game, you've still got to somehow address that issue. But thankfully, the Cypher system doesn't have a lot of that. But again, that's because... even though the Cypher system started with Numenera, I always kind of had it in the back of my mind that this was a system that could sort of be easily used for anything. And you know, the key, the other thing that I would say is figuring out what are the key elements of the system. What makes, for example, a Cypher game? And the two things, and there are only two, that I would say are, you know, the players get to use, they get to sort of determine when they use effort, right? So I as a player have a great deal of control over my character, maybe more so than in other games or some other games, because I get to decide, okay, this action is really important to me, so I'm really going to put my resources into this one, and you know, maybe next time I'm not. And so that's really important to the Cypher system. And then the ciphers themselves, which are, you know, something that's actually pretty easily ported into any system, because all ciphers are temporary sort of one-use abilities that are always changing, right? And so that can be, like in Numenera, some weird device. In a magical world, it could be magic items, but in, you know, a straightforward sort of game, it could just be bits of inspiration or luck or whatever, right? But the fun part of it is that, you know, your character abilities in one small way are always changing. And so you're always going to have some new opportunity, some new option in the game system that you maybe didn't have last session. And, you know, that kind of gives the game a more dynamic feel that way.
I think another interesting example, too, is, you know, we started No Thank You Evil sort of as a cipher system game, because that's kind of, and because we started with the sentences. And so the ways that we tweaked that to make it suit that game, I think, are really interesting. So we made it so that the beginner players or younger players only have one word, I'm a blank. And so then if you're a little older or you play more role player games, you get I'm a blank blank. And then as it goes, you get I'm a blank blank who blanks. And so each one gets sort of progressively harder. So we kept the sort of
core. Give an example.
So I'm a super smart scientist who loves pizza. It's like one of the characters that you can play in No Thank You Evil. So if you started out, you just be I'm a scientist, right? And then you're I'm a super smart scientist, and then I'm a super smart scientist who loves pizza. So each one gives you more cool things. And then we typically have three pools, but we knew that in No Thank You Evil, one of the things that we really wanted to focus on was kids helping each other. And so we added a fourth pool, which was just your awesome pool. And you can only spend awesome points to help someone else. And so we wanted that to be a pool that existed to help make teamwork and sharing and do these awesome things. And so it only works if someone else gets in a bind or if you want to help someone else. And so it was really easy to add this other pool because it just had a very specific use with a very specific goal. And then ciphers were a weird one because ciphers are part of the cipher system, but we didn't want kids to have to sort of keep track of something, and we didn't want them to have to do math, and we didn't want them to be complex. And so in this world, your companion, because they have pets in No Thank You Evil, like is your cipher, and so it gets this cool new ability, and so it can grow twice as big, or it can zoom you around like a race car. And so the ciphers sort of become integrated, and you feed your pet a treat, and it gets a new cipher. And so we wanted it to be a thing that was really active, but still sort of retain that core. And so we do a lot of work with taking these core elements of what works and then kind of, you know, trying different things. We tried a bunch of different things with the ciphers, but No Thank You Evil, and how to make them fun and cool and interesting without them being sort of cumbersome or just a thing that didn't appeal to kids.
Any last questions? Okay.
You talked briefly about the Your Best Game Ever Kickstarter. Also, though, with that, I believe there is a new cipher system core book that you're working on. And so I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about that, how you're updating the system, and maybe some of the settings that were also teased that were coming out as like stretch goals for that.
Sure. So, you know, we've got right now a cipher system rule book that is sort of setting agnostic, right, where you just get the cipher system rules. But when we started coming up with the concepts for Your Best Game Ever and these things that we wanted to, you know, suggest that you could add into whatever game you play, I realized that what we should follow up Your Best Game Ever with is an actual game that it becomes a companion piece to Your Best Game Ever. So what the new version, it doesn't change the rules, but it's still the same rule system, but now, like, if we encourage you in Your Best Game Ever to adopt some interesting options that might make your game more fun, we're going to port those directly into the cipher system. For example, we've been talking about Invisible Sun's character arcs. Your Best Game Ever will basically give you what you need, the ideas that you need to take that character arc system and use it in whatever game you play, whether you're playing D&D or Pathfinder or Call of Cthulhu. And then what the new cipher system rulebook will do is it will also take character arcs and it will tell you this is exactly how you use them in the cipher system and this is exactly how many experience points you award for every step. And so It is the show your work part of the whole system. So I imagine that those books will be really, really great sort of companion pieces to each other. And then, like as you said, because the Kickstarter did pretty well, we unlocked a lot of stretch goals. And so we're kind of delving deeper we're going to do a science fiction focused book that is called The Stars Are Fire, and that will have lots of cool advice and rules and whatnot to use for a science fiction game, and then a fully realized usable setting that is for the Cypher system, but really, you know, pretty applicable to any game. And then there's a horror book on the same lines called Stay Alive, a fantasy book called God Forsaken, and lastly, sort of a fairy tale myth book called We Are All Mad Here. So all four of those books will be following in the footsteps of Your Best Game Ever in the new Cypher System rulebook to kind of form a path of melding the Cypher System along with sort of general guidelines for whatever game you play.
This is kind of a meta game design question. So we play 3.5 Pathfinder Planescape, and one of the things about that system is that story and crunch are somewhat separate, right? We're a very story-driven group, but the story-driven stuff happens when we all just get together and talk about narrative, independent of any particular system, and the crunch is only loosely coupled to that. You know, and the coupling is by GM fiat, right? The players do really cool story things, and then we have a conversation about what kind of crunch effect we'd like that to have, and then I write it as GM, and then it happens. And the alternative to that seems to be systems like Fate, or the computer games of Alexis Kennedy, Sunless Sea, and Cultist Simulator, where you might have an item in your inventory that is a physical object, and you might have an item in your inventory that is a story that you heard last week, and they're treated mechanically identically, or in Fate. You know, you might have an aspect that's, I have a gun, you might have an aspect that is, I believe all knowledge is worth having, and those two things are treated identically. Can you talk a bit about that continuum between story and crunch wrapped together in one big ball of mechanics versus the separate stuff in 3.5?
Okay. I think that there is no wrong answer there, and different ways of approaching that issue will appeal to different people. I am currently a game designer who happens to be a fan of bringing them more together, and so, you know, you will have things like Invisible Sun, for example. Every character belongs to a magical order, and that order, as you progress through that order, you know, it's like going up in level, right? You'll get access to new abilities and whatnot. But at the same time, these are actual magical orders that exist in the world, and there are organizations. I mean, it is an organization. There are, you know, if you are a member of the Order of Makers, there are other Order of Makers, and there's a hierarchy there, and you might be given responsibilities as you raise up, get more and more advanced in the Order of Makers. And so suddenly that's a big part of the story. You know, if you raise from third degree to fourth degree maker, suddenly that, you know, that means, oh, I get some, you know, increases in the things that my character can do, but it also means, you know, now I've got these other NPCs who want to talk to me and come to me with ideas and whatnot for making new things, and I have to answer to a higher level maker who wants me to do this thing for them, and suddenly, you know, the game mechanics and the world become so intertwined that you're not really sure where one stops and the other starts. And I think that can be very powerful because, you know, sometimes if you divorce them entirely, and you know your D&D characters are sitting around in a tavern, and you're talking about the things that you can do or the things that you have done, there's always this sort of disconnect of, well, you know, do I tell people that I'm a level 14 wizard, right, and that I can cast this many spells in a day, or is that the language that we would use? And so I think that the more you can have a player talk about the things that they're doing in the same way that their character would talk about the things that they're doing, I think that that's just a really good feeling, and that's a really good synthesis, and you don't have to sort of have those situations where, like, oh, are you talking in character? Or are you talking game mechanics? And if it all just sort of blends together, you don't have to worry about that.
It's kind of like for Invisible Sun, you also, the things that you earn through your character arcs or sometimes just through experiences, you can earn joy or you can earn despair. And So if a thing happens that scares you or freaks you out or you watch your friend get hurt, you earn despair. But if you succeed at a thing or you see something, like my character is very concerned with fashion. So, you know, she sees this most amazing angel in this fashionable dress, she gets joy. But in order to sort of advance one particular, you know, some particular elements of your character, you have to have both. You have to have one of each. So you can't just be like, I'm going to be a joyrider. You have to get despair and joy in order to advance. So the things that your character experiences emotionally allow you to get better and interesting. And so that's like such a beautiful way to sort of move through that world, I think.
And it's sort of like real life, right? You learn from your mistakes as well as your successes. Maybe sometimes even better from your mistakes than from your successes.
I think we have time for it. Yeah.
Yep. So to finish up, kind of in the context of the different systems you've talked about, do you have any particular advice for people looking at moving from, you know, players to GMs?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So like I said, I'm always the GM, and I like to be easy on the GM. So I'm the guy who says, you know, we put too much responsibility on the GM, right? Because it's a group activity. And so, you know, yes, the GM brings the setting and the story and, you know, plays the NPCs and portrays the setting to the players and whatnot. But that doesn't mean that the GM also has to solve everybody's problems and, you know, make sure that everyone's having a good time or whatever. That's the group's responsibility. It's, as a player, I think it's just as much your responsibility as any. You know, if you see two players in conflict with each other, it's everybody's responsibility to help solve that problem, right? It's a group activity, and so I don't know how I got off on this tangent, but I guess that's a long way of saying, you know, don't feel like if you become the game master that you have to do everything and you have to be, you know, not just the person running the game, but everybody's mom and right. And you know, I would even go so far as to say, you know, you don't have to be the person who hosts the game. It doesn't have to be in your home, right? Because that's an extra level of responsibility and whatnot. But other than that, I read something that someone else wrote not very long ago, and it was actually kind of derogatory toward role-playing games, but the premise was that role-playing games are these games where everyone sits down and pretends like they know what they're doing, but nobody really does. there's a grain of truth to that, right? So, I mean, even if you're the game master, you don't have to know everything. You don't have to know, you know, you don't have to be the one who's memorized the rules. In fact, sometimes it's best if you've got a player at the table who is the person who really knows the rules. You can kind of defer to them, right? I'm all about sharing the burden, I guess, is the way this goes. And, and the reason that this is so important to me is because I talk to so many people who are like, well, nobody in my game, you know, nobody in my group really wants to run games because it's so hard and whatnot. And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be hard. You don't have to have more responsibility than anybody else. You are one person around a table of friends. You've got a different role than everybody, but it's not like the whole weight of the world is not on your shoulders.
That's mostly what I was just going to say. I also think co-GMing is a really fantastic way to take, especially if you're feeling pressure or you're uncertain. Like, if someone else knows the rules and you are great at narratives and NPC, like, just split the duties. And then, Monty, we were talking about this the other day, like, and then if the party splits, you can split the party, right? You each get a GM in a different room, and suddenly you have this amazing experience when you come back together. We did this at actually a company summit, and it was utterly chaotic and wonderful. But, like, so co-GM, like, share the burdens, and whether that means you GM one week and they GM the other, or you GM at the same time, like, just until you sort of feel comfortable and get your feet sort of onto you, I think that's great. You can search on YouTube to watch people co-GM and see how they split it up. A lot of times people who do a convention for the first time co-GM with someone who's done a lot of convention games just to kind of pick up the rules and take the pressure off. And other than that, I think there's sometimes this idea that the GM sort of has this secret space and they know what they're doing and the players just show up. And I think actually like enlisting your players to help you as much as possible is totally awesome, right? Like there's nothing wrong with one of the players being your rules backup or one of the players like, you know, I mean, especially we were talking earlier about like quiet players and I'm a super quiet player. So like have your players help that player make space, right? So you don't have to do that all. So I think like you know what your players are good at or your players know what they're good at. And so ask them to help you. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You don't have to sort of walk in and be the expert on all that stuff.
This podcast is not affiliated with Monty Cook Games. It is here for information and entertainment purposes only. Music is by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.